Dr. Shabbat, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you on the program. We've been looking forward to this. I wanted to ask you first, what has most surprised you about COVID-19? I mean, you've probably known about it for two and a half months or so. What has surprised you about this disease?
Well, I think for me personally, when this virus was first described, there was a lot of press around it being a mystery virus or something truly bizarre, but we in the medical community thought, well, it's a coronavirus, and coronaviruses are kind of a known entity. That logic turned out to be not entirely correct, of course, because this is, substantially different from other coronaviruses that we've seen. And things that have been surprising for me have been the severity and hospitalization rates and mortality rates, the likes of which we have not seen with other coronaviruses or even novel viruses of other sorts, like, influenza. There were several new strains of influenza in recent decades, and those didn't turn out to be as severe as this one did, certainly. So that has certainly kept us very busy, as you, of course, know.
And of all the questions that you do have about COVID-19, and I'm sure you have many, if you could choose one question that you'd like to have answered that has not been answered yet, what would that be?
I think it would be the host immunity after infection. There is a lot of research going on about the people who have recovered from their coronavirus and how protected they are and how long they will be protected. I think those are going to be really important questions going forward. Some of the really interesting treatments that are being studied now involve using serum from people who have recovered to use those antibodies that they have developed. Those trials are very much in their infancy, but they've been really promising. And how long do people have these antibodies I think, a really valid question, as well as will one person's immunity continue to protect them for long periods of time from this new strain of coronavirus that we will undoubtedly be living with for years?
So, Matthew, it seems as though COVID operates differently than some infectious diseases, a lot of infectious diseases. But what would be the rule of thumb with that? I mean, in terms of how long we have developed a natural antibody or immunity against something once we've already had it?
Well, for many other infectious diseases, it's widely considered that once you have antibodies to it, those can persist decades or even a lifetime. Many vaccinations that we give cause those antibodies to be produced. And while some vaccinations need boosters routinely, such as like your tetanus booster every 10 years, some vaccinations are much more long-lasting. We think of measles, mumps, rubella vaccination given in childhood as, probably close to lifelong. So, like I mentioned, I think that's going to be one of the really interesting things about this virus is to see how protected people can be in the long term.
Yeah. A question that I think has come up a lot around, what we knew a month ago and what we know now, it's so different in a lot of different realms within this disease, everything from testing to false positives, air masks, and things like that. And I'm wondering, I mean, let's talk a little bit about face masks and the effectiveness. We were first told that we're not supposed to wear a mask unless we're sick, because the virus can, if we are wearing a mask and we get it from the outside, it can kind of get inside the mask, and then it creates, sort of a stronger attack on us if it's trapped within this mask. Now we're hearing, we can fold up a bandana, put a few rubber bands on it, and that's great. What is the prevailing science on that?
So there's different recommendations certainly on this. The CDC, as you know, recently came out with that cloth mask recommendation, but the WHO has not. I think the logic behind homemade cloth masks is something is better than nothing. And the research on this is very wishy-washy. What we know about how coronavirus transmits is that it is very much a droplet transmission. There's some debate about short-range aerosol, and I'll talk about that. But when we think about droplet transmission, it's really globules of saliva and mucus that are traveling out of the nose when you sneeze or cough, and they really drop like lead balloons. That's why the six-foot rule has widely been talked about, and that's probably more important than masks. I think masks can be an adjunct to that, and most of the CDC guidelines really stress that. It's like, yes, you can, and if you're in New York, should wear a cloth mask, but really the social distancing protects you more. How the masks work is basically just trapping those droplets before they escape into like a wide range around you. So a cloth mask probably prevents you from infecting other people a little better. And then in terms of preventing you getting infected, that's where the evidence gets a little sketchy because, the droplets may hit the outside of your mask. And if you don't touch the outside of your mask, that is helping. And if the mask prevents you from touching your own face, that's probably also helping. But it gets into a lot of how people use these masks. And I think a lot of us have seen folks in the grocery store or on the street using these masks. And what drives me crazy is people always touching the masks and adjusting them. And, touching the outside of the mask and then touching their face or, like, pulling down the mask to rub their nose, in which case it probably is not helping as much as we think. So I think it's certainly fine to wear cloth masks. I think it also sort of sends a message socially that, you are taking this virus seriously and taking your social distancing seriously, and I think that's probably okay. But as actual hard science with masks goes, there's not a ton, and what studies there are, some are conflicting. So that's what I tell my patients about cloth masks.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I like that. I just pulled my mask off that I was constantly touching while we while we've been sitting here.
I mean, we all do. Yeah. Even in the University of Utah, we've just gone to, like, we all have to wear masks all the time, regardless of whether we're face-to-face with a patient. And I think even our staff is sort of grappling with, how do you not touch this, like, kind of irritating thing that's on your face and makes it a little hard to breathe and things like that?
Well, we're trying to help our listeners out there, and just a thought to stop you from touching your face. If you have a glass of wine in one hand, if you actually pick up another glass of wine in the other hand, then you probably won't touch your face. You just need to figure out a way to imbibe it through the mask. Just a thought. Hey, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Matthew Shabbat. He's a primary care internal medicine doctor at the University of Utah Healthcare, with a special emphasis on preventive medicine, infectious disease, substance abuse, and obesity. We're talking to him about COVID-19. And if you have questions for the doctor, get them to us via email at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. Dr. Shabbat, I was watching, and I know there's a lot of misinformation out there, but I was surprised to hear a couple of numbers. There was a medical directory responsible for a hospital somewhere in the UK, and he was saying that 50% of the people that are admitted into an ICU, and to be admitted into an ICU, you're going to have to be sick, 50% succumb to the illness, pass away. And, you hear so much about ventilators and how important they are, and they are important, but the same doctor, medical director, said that 2/3 of people that are on ventilators for COVID-19 succumb to the disease. Did those numbers make sense?
Yeah. And I think this is a valuable conversation to have, is that, yeah, ventilators are not curing an issue. They are a last-ditch effort. And by the time you get on a ventilator, you are desperately ill. And Those mortality rates, I certainly believe those numbers out of the UK. Those are different according to various hospitals. Each hospital is a little bit different in their criteria to put somebody on a ventilator, et cetera. But those mortality rates are always high. And mostly by the time you get onto a ventilator, they're usually trying experimental therapies and trying to wait it out and keep you alive long enough for your immune system to eventually fight off the virus effectively. But by the time you're on the ventilator, you're usually going through something called ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome. And that gets into something where it's not only the virus that's causing the issue, but it's probably also some part of your immune response that has started to damage your lungs. And that's a really hard cascade of events to fix. And there's a lot of really good doctors out there that are trying some experimental therapies and even known therapies for ARDS, because it's not a new idea. Certainly people have had ARDS from other coronaviruses in the past, but this particular coronavirus seems more apt to set off that cascade of events that results in lung failure and need for a ventilator. So, the vast majority of patients with COVID will not get there and, maybe fine at home or maybe fine on a minimal amount of oxygen. But for those that get that progressed, the outlook is certainly grim.
Dr. Shabbat, did you want to talk about testing at Park City Ice Arena and under what circumstances that is done and how to make it happen?
Yeah, certainly. So the testing protocols through the university and through Intermountain Health Center are, basically being combined into this Park City testing station, is my understanding. There's also many more testing locations down in the valley. Basically, we are looking for everyone that has a fever and a cough, and that's where most of our people qualify. If you have a fever, or, even a subjective fever, you don't need to necessarily have a thermometer in your house because those are increasingly hard to come by. But a fever and a cough, we will test you every time. There are plenty of people who have more mild cases, and for people who have just a cough or just respiratory symptoms, we want to test the people who are high risk. And for us, high risk is if you're over 65, if you're pregnant, or if you're immunocompromised, or if you've been in contact with someone we know has COVID. So if you have any sort of a interpersonal contact with someone who is swabbed positive, and you have a respiratory symptom, it's worth getting tested. So that ends up to be a fair amount of people, but certainly not all of the people that show up for testing qualify. And so, for example, if you just come into contact with someone but have no symptoms, we probably shouldn't be testing you. These tests are not perfect, and they are still limited. So, and that gets a little bit to what we mentioned earlier about the false negatives for this test. This test is really good at picking up people who are ill and have virus replicating in their nose. So it depends on how much virus is there and where we catch you during your illness. And we think that probably relates to why some people with the virus, we don't manage to find it on the first swab. So we can repeat the testing at some point, but...
Yeah, there are so many questions surrounding this. I knew of someone who did test positive, and they didn't want to test him because he didn't actually have a fever. But it turned out that he had enough other symptoms. And one of those, the first onset that I've heard, and I was curious about, and actually got a question sent to us about this, about the fact that some people, the onset is this inability to taste or smell. Could you comment on that?
Mm. Yeah, that's certainly described in a lot of COVID patients. The exact percentage varies depending on what paper you read. Whether it's like a defining characteristic is still sort of being hashed out. all of the symptoms we have for COVID are present in variable amounts depending on the stage of the disease. So like for fever, for example, not everyone has fever at the time they show up for testing. We know that maybe about 85% of people will have fever at some point during their illness, but that doesn't always help us in the immediate sense. Similarly, numbers for the lack of sense of smell can range between 50 and 60% in some studies that I've read, but it's not a surefire thing, certainly. So when we made these testing parameters at the University of Utah, it was very much a balance between how are we most likely to find the most people, yet not overwhelm our testing capabilities. I think in an ideal world, you would test everybody regardless of symptoms. Mm-hmm. But, for example, the sense of taste and smell has not made it onto our testing criteria yet. But those are subject to change. So I always encourage people to call in to the University of Utah. And if you call any of our urgent care numbers, they can walk you through what our testing parameters are at the moment ask you about your symptoms and let you know whether we want to have you down through one of our testing centers to get swabbed.
Right. And as the executive director of our health department in Summit County keeps saying, act as though everyone you run into or everyone around you has COVID-19 and act as though you have it as well. And just that will keep us all safe and enable us to, really think about the social distancing. I want to ask you another question. We don't have that much time left. And this also came in a question from one of our listeners about limiting exposure. So we're not perfect. As you say, we touch our face or our face mask or we touch doorknobs. And if we are, 99% perfect about how we move through our day and we end up getting COVID, it may mean a limited exposure equals a limited severity. Would that be true?
That has been suggested that the amount of virus that you encounter can determine a little bit how severe your illness is. And that idea kind of came through healthcare providers who were exposed to very sick people. Of course, this is in different countries, primarily in Italy, where they had PPE, but maybe the protective equipment was not optimal all the time. So for whatever reason, healthcare providers seem to get more severe illness. And that sort of grew into this idea that the more virus you get exposed to on your initial inoculum, your initial dose, can determine how bad your course is. I don't think there's anything to say that for sure. I certainly hope that's possible, that if you are exposed to a very, very small amount in the grocery store, your disease will probably be less. But I guess I can't say that for any certain way today. But I agree that we want to do as good as we can with social distancing, but not everyone can be perfect. I don't know how much we can reassure ourselves with the small exposures, but I certainly hope that's true.
Telephone number for everybody. If you're experiencing COVID-19 symptoms, you can call the University of Utah's Health Coronavirus Hotline, 801-587-0712. For an initial screening, and then it'll be determined if you should be evaluated by a healthcare professional, those sorts of things. Anyway, that number again is 801-587-0712. Dr. Shabbat, before we let you go, actually probably don't have too much time, but quickly, the HCQ testing clinical trials, some of those will be in Utah with, I believe, involving 2,300 patients. In about 30 seconds, what are your thoughts on HCQ? Because the testing sample from France was so small.
Yeah, I think it's really impossible to say whether hydroxychloroquine or azithromycin, these two investigational medicines, will help COVID patients. So I don't use them in COVID patients that I've encountered in the community. I think they're really only only being used in a controlled study sense. These two studies are going to be very interesting to see the results. They're using them both on people in the hospital to see if they can get better and people out of the hospital to see if we can prevent them from getting worse. And it'll be some time before we have those results and many other trials that are being done around the world. But I think it's, I would really encourage people to not, take these medicines preemptively or, ask your doctor for them, immediately. They're very unknown at this point.
Dr. Matthew Shabbat, thanks so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
It was my pleasure.
And we hope to have you back. Stay safe and well, and we hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks, Matthew.
All right, thanks.